This is Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we'll have in the studio Tom Pappas with the City of Portage Veterans Committee. It's a regular visit to talk about things like the upcoming committee meeting and some other items, too, of interest to veterans here in Northwest Indiana. Stephen Lattimore will have a report for us as well on how the dean of the Valparaiso University School of Law is being recognized as a legal legend by the American Constitutional Society. We'll find out why. And we'll also bring back a conversation with Kathy Sipple about the CoThrive Time Bank and how it's picked up an Innovation Award. Things to report here on the veteran scene these days here in Northwest Indiana, and for that we're bringing back into the studio Tom Pappas, who's a member of the City of Portage Veterans Committee. Tom, thanks for joining us once again today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
One of the things that we wanted to talk about first here is actually it takes effect on Friday, July 1st. It's a new law. It's a new law that is going to allow, the state to thank veterans for their service by giving service members and their spouses some preferential treatment for employment and training. And this is something we've talked about before, too, about the opportunity that needs to be posed out there to get not only veterans and their spouses the kind of help that they need. That, in turn, will help get them, both of them, or both certainly whole families, better jobs and in turn, better income.
Oh, yes, and if you notice your release there, we have a very low veteran unemployment rate. And legislation like that is good, except when you get into the inner cities and the veterans have no transportation. Mm-hmm. That's the big problem. You can pass a lot of legislation, but if a veteran can't take advantage of it, it means nothing.
For folks that aren't familiar with what this law says, it's going to require the Indiana Department of Workforce Development to give a veteran or spouse priority for placement in any state or federal employment or training program that is administered by the Department of Workforce Development. And they have, of course, to have the documents showing that the veteran has an honorable discharge from the service, and they have to, of course, meet the eligibility requirements for whatever training or employment program that they were looking into. So it certainly ought to get them a better chance to look for a better job or to have one.
And that kind of keys into what they've been doing, where when workforce development gets a new job posting, veterans that are on record with them get one day's advance opportunity to put in for it. The first day only veterans know about the opening. Mm-hmm. It's a good deal.
A fellow who is the State Veterans Program Director for the DWA, his name is Michael Thompson. Says that that veterans tend to stick to something they believe in, so they're looking for employers that'll do the same for them. And also it helps, goes back to their core values that they have and then what they happen to be taught in the military as well, too.
Most certainly, yes.
Once again, this is going to be a new law that takes effect on Friday, July 1st, along with a number of others here that will take effect here in Indiana. Some of these have been enacted by the General Assembly, and some of them are just changes that are going to take place there.
Correct.
Like this one in particular. Last time we talked, we an introduction of sorts to the Veterans Experience program
that's
coming up. We talked about this because this was something that we know that the head of the Jesse Brown VA Hospital, as well as the medical centers around Northwest Indiana, was going to talk about. I guess maybe we should ask, how did that conversation go last time?
It went very well. This Veterans Experience Group offers veterans a unique chance to make a difference in their lives. You look at all the programming that's coming down the pike. You've got the proactive leadership that the JB director represents in his administration. Mm-hmm. You have the telehealth program that's coming into play. You have changes in the Choice Act. And what's unique, I think a contributing factor to changing the course of the VA, is now they're giving more power to new nurse practitioners. They were very limited until recently. Mm-hmm. And when you look at it, it opened telehealth, especially with everything else thrown in, opens up the opportunity to, for veterans to not have to make long trips to Jesse Brown. It makes it easier to serve the veteran population in the country. And when you look at the administration and the employees at ABJ and Jesse Brown, administration very proactive, very pro-veteran. If veterans don't take advantage of this opportunity, they're foolish. They're really missing the boat.
Now you talk about expanding the role in the clinics and every place. I suppose that the nurse practitioners play.
Yes,
we know there are a lot of nurse practitioners that are working at the Crown Point facility in particular, and of course with others all across the country. What is likely to be their role? Or you mentioned they'll be able to do more.
And I don't know. I'm not a knowledgeable in that technical area, but they were limited prior to the legislation. Just doing basically nurse work. Mm-hmm. Now they can assume legally what they were given in the private sector, they can do now in the VA sector.
That's great, yeah, because we know that nurse practitioners in the private sector have quite a bit of a responsibility, not quite as much as an MD, but they get pretty close, very, very close to it. So that'll be very good for people that rely on a nurse practitioner to take a look at the charts and the information and conduct the exams and the like, as well as order the prescriptions.
Yes, what I see happening with nurse practitioners is if you need to go to Jesse Brown for some kind of routine test, nothing real complicated, a nurse practitioner could be at ABJ on one end of a TV hookup, and the specialist could be at JB and give the nurse practitioner directions, like maybe you need to take a sample or something, a tissue sample or something, whatever. Now the handcuffs are off the nurse practitioners.
That's great. That's great to hear. Before we got together, I got a copy of one of the forms that you passed along here that talks about the veteran experience team. Tell us what this form is going to allow people who are involved in the program to do, that's going to in turn make it better for all Northwest Indiana veterans.
We're trying to identify the problems that veterans are having in a general sense, and this is just the first document. This was put together based on the big issues at town hall meetings. Mm-hmm. We didn't put anything related to claims on this because this program is not aimed at addressing claims issues. It's more about addressing the health issues, transportation issues, those major issues related to ABJ and JB.
A couple points that are on this experience team checklist here, or at least a discussion list, you mentioned about transportation, about shuttle buses, as well as transportation for rural veterans.
Yes.
I mean, we're talking here, I suppose, mainly about getting from wherever they happen to be to Chicago.
Yes, one of the buses, if you look at the shuttle buses, they need to be upgraded, okay? There are no bathrooms on the shuttle buses. And when you're on the bus for an hour or a little bit longer, it would be nice to have a bathroom.
Yeah, especially for those long trips, say, from LaPorte or Michigan City or places off to the east when you have to make that trek onto the toll road and go into Chicago.
There's something wrong with the buses and but then again, it's going to be interesting to see how many veterans will need to go to JB with the advent of telehealth and the nurse practitioners and the changes in the choice program.
Does it seem, and did the comments come in from the town hall meetings that you attended, that veterans don't mind going to Jesse Brown if they have to go, but they would rather stay closer to home, either Crown Point or another spot nearby?
Well, you break it down to two parts. One, veterans and how they feel about the care they receive at Jesse Brown. And two, the transportation issues related to getting to Jesse Brown. Aren't too many veterans like going to Jesse Brown. but there's a pretty high percentage that like the doctors that they have at Jesse Brown.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, it's probably that trip into the medical district in downtown
yes.
Chicago that's no fun, which is true. It's I've been on the shuttle buses before, and it's a long drive, long ride.
Long ride.
It's probably a long drive for some of those bus drivers, too. It's a rather tough trip to make, but it has to be made because a lot of the services that are offered at JB mm-hmm. can't. Probably for financial reasons, it would be too expensive to set up the outpatient clinics with the equipment and services.
Well, and this director said this, there will be no more medical centers built. Mm-hmm. The ones that are there are there. I see a switch again. The telehealth is going to come into play. Choice Act changes, and everybody has to remember they're digitalizing. All the medical records. So now, not only can the VHA, Veterans Health Administration, work with the Department of Defense, which was a problem before, now the private sector can access your medical records from when you were in the service.
Now, from the impression that you got in talking with the Jesse Brown director when he was here in Northwest Indiana, did they set up a kind of a timetable? You've gotten started working on the veterans' experience teams.
Yes.
When they like to have certain be at certain places to be able to make the improvements?
We have not gotten that far. Mm-hmm. We just had our second meeting a week ago, mm-hmm. and that was a real organizational meeting. I'm hoping by the end of end of July, we'll have a good feel for what we need to do and be moving forward on getting it done. In fact, I'm thinking in August at the city meeting just to have a big sit-down with any veteran that comes in so I can bring them up to speed on where we're at with this Veterans Experience Program.
So a great opportunity here for folks that make it to the City
yes.
of Portage Veterans Committee meetings as they happen the first of each month in Portage.
Wednesday, first Wednesday, 5 o'clock, mm-hmm. Woodland Park.
And they'll have a chance, they'll find out what the latest is. And
yes.
And I get the impression, as we've talked before even, that the folks at Jesse Brown, in particular the director of the facility, has put this on a fast track. He wants to see something happen something implemented even before the end of the year, if possible.
Oh, I'm sure. I made a comment to somebody the other day that I hope this thing is pretty well under control by the end of August.
Wow. Well, that's very possible.
He's
good to know.
Moving. He has a great person, Pat Gleason. And he has the support of all the administrators at Adam Benjamin and all the department heads at Jesse Brown.
That's great. Now, we talked here a lot about the healthcare system and about the improvements that are being sought to be made locally with the medical centers as well as there at the hospital in Chicago. Any other topics that are coming up here on the agenda for the meeting coming up here in Portage?
Well, the meeting next Wednesday, we're going to have a video on speaking up, and that's important for veterans to come and watch. And we're also going to have a presentation on telehealth by one of the administrators in the JB telehealth department.
That's great.
And that's very important for veterans to know what's out there for them to take advantage of.
Kind of like what we just talked about here about the opportunity to help for the doctors back in Chicago to have a hookup with the nurse practitioners and the other
yes.
physicians and the clinics out there to get to work with the patients and make sure that they get the right help. That's great.
And the rural veterans, there's some talk mm-hmm. about making changes to help facilitate them getting medical care. But that's in its infancy right now.
That's great. We've been talking with Tom Pappas, who is a member of the City of Portage Veterans Committee, about some interesting topics and important topics for veterans here in Northwest Indiana. And as always, Tom, thank you for coming by. And we will look forward to the next visit. We'll find out more how the Veterans Experience Team is doing and working with making some very important changes that are pretty much mandated by the director of the Jesse Brown Hospital in Chicago.
He's basically said either or.
That's a good way to put it. That's wonderful. Well, thank you again for
being
with us
Chris.
Today, Tom. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. The dean of the Valparaiso University School of Law is being recognized as a legal legend by the American Constitutional Society. Because of her work, Illinois and several other states have stopped using the death penalty. Lakeshore Public Radio Stephen Lattimore was there when her work was recognized with the national award.
University Law School Dean Andrea Lyon has received the Abner Mikva Award from the American Constitution Society. The award is given to those lawyers who have made an extraordinary contribution to the Chicago legal community, who uphold the United States Constitution and defend social justice.
Yeah, I've been doing death penalty defense my whole life. I'm the first woman in the United States to ever defend a death penalty case, and so far I won 100% of my cases.
Andrea Lyon was named Dean of Valparaiso University Law School in 2014. Prior to becoming dean, she worked for the Cook County Public Defender's Office. Lyon also defended more than 30 capital cases at the trial level. 19 of those cases made it to the penalty phase, and Lyon won all 19. She worked with former Illinois Governor George Ryan, who stopped executions in Illinois.
And saved a lot of people from being convicted that were innocent, and worked on a lot of innocent projects, still does. And this award that she got here today was more than deserving. I'm glad she got it. It was just a no-brainer for me to do what I did. I mean, people were going to jail, and then all of a sudden, after 10 or 15 years of sitting on death row, I said to myself, how does that happen in America? How do people sit on death row for 15 years and then all of a sudden find out they're innocent? I just talked to a fellow that was here. Said he sat in death row for 29 years waiting to be executed.
Evan Griffith is one of Lyon's clients who is now free because of her work.
She saved my life. She understood where I came from, what I did, and she understood that justice wasn't serving my case. And she fought hard, and she's a great person to have on my team. I was on death row for 11 years. I was incarcerated for 29 altogether. 11 of them were spent on death row. Governor Ryan gave us a commutation in 2003. As a result, I had a life sentence, and Andrew Lyons and others fought with me and for me. And as a result, I was given time considered to serve. I'm gainfully employed for the last 5 years for a great company, and I'm just grateful for all of the great people in my life.
Dean Lyons says she teaches her students that they have to make a difference.
You need to understand that law is not a job, it's a calling. And it's more than, it's a privilege to be able to practice law. And you have to, if there's something you can do to make things better, it's your obligation to do that. And it's your obligation to find those things. And I tell them, don't roll your eyes when anybody says something corny like you're supposed to help the world be a better place. Because you are.
In Chicago, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
The creator of the Valparaiso-based CoThrive Time Bank says the inspiration for the Time Bank came from a Dune Learning Center project on, well, I guess it was called, for other reasons, a wild edibles hike. And Kathy Sipple talked recently about that hike and how the Time Bank has grown since then.
The Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana has once again handed out another award to Kathy Sipple with the Northwest Indiana Time Bank. And this time, Kathy is with us to talk about how the Time Bank and a so-called wild edible hike happened to be related. Kathy, thanks for being with us. And tell the story, if you will, about this interesting kind of experience, a hike of some sort, and how it's kind of turned into something that's much, much more involved than that.
Yeah, well, thanks, Chris. I really appreciate you having me on again. If I can just kind of take you from A to B, you and I spoke, I believe, last March, just a little over a year ago, about the Time Bank just getting started. Yep. And in May of that year, just exactly a year ago, we had a trainer come out and train our local Time Bank that was then just a fledgling organization just getting off the ground. Her name was Linda Hogan, and she had quite a bit of experience with Time Banks. She suggested that most successful time banks need to find their it, you know, something to build passion around, you know, interconnectedness around. And I just happen to be very passionate about wild edibles, and I love doing hikes. So I got kind of known for that, and it turned out that was a perfect thing to offer through the time bank because it's not something that I really wanted to do as a business per se. So therefore, when the Dunes Learning Center approached me last year and asked me if I could offer them a wild edible hike for their silent auction, I now had a currency to propose for them. Instead of just offering it to them as a straight-up volunteer, I asked them if they would give me credit within the time bank for my donation of time.
Mm-hmm.
And they said yes. Although they didn't have a lot of staff time to donate, they did have a beautiful lodge right up there on their lakefront property right on Lake Michigan. And they offered me use of their lodge back in January to host a time bank event in exchange for me donating that wild edible hike.
Now, speaking of a wild edible hike, people maybe may have heard about this, certainly hearing about it now. What does that involve? Is it just strictly going out there and looking for things that folks might not normally find at the supermarket?
Yeah, absolutely. It just happens to be a passion of mine. That passion was flamed, first during my coursework as an Indiana Master Naturalist. I took that class 2 years ago. Really loved it, loved the whole thing, but was probably most captivated by the section about wild edibles, which some people call foraging, others call wild crafting, using nature's gift a little bit more intentionally, not just taking all that we can, but harvesting sustainably, harvesting, with the intention to eat or to use, the items medicinally. There are plenty of other items that, are out there besides mushrooms, but mushrooms are also one of my favorites and one that I have taken some additional training for through the Hoosier Mushroom Society.
That seems to be the one thing that probably people think of first when they think of going out looking for wild edibles, or figuring out hunting for mushrooms, or maybe out looking for wild truffles or things like that.
Yeah, and I've never found truffles, so I'd love to do that. They're under the ground, and I think I need to get a pet pig to help
yeah,
with that.
They seem to be very, very adept at finding these things, and so if you can keep them from eating them all, I suppose.
Exactly, exactly. And so the situation with mushrooms is that, until recently, this is the third year now that the Hoosier Mushroom Society has been offering certification on both morels and wild mushrooms, and I do have both of those certifications. So they can serve as a licensing body that make it possible for me to basically be almost like a notary public for mushrooms. I can stamp mushrooms found by others or by myself to resell to restaurants or to farmers markets. And so although that's not the reason that I started offering, the wild edible hikes, it's just through a pure love of doing it, I have trained some other time bank members well enough to find mushrooms confidently to feed their families. And last fall, they found such an abundance of mushrooms that all of a sudden we had a surplus and began to reach out to local restaurants to see if there was interest in purchasing them for making, items in their restaurants.
Oh, but have you had any takers on that?
We have. We actually had Uptown Cafe in Valparaiso. They were our very first client,
mm-hmm.
and they bought an abundance of maitake mushrooms and made a really wonderful cream of mushroom soup last fall.
Wow.
And then we had Chef Barry from the Shoreline Brewery. He ended up buying quite a large quantity from us to use at a farm-to-table dinner that was held at the Lubesnik Center for the Arts. And then Andrea from the Rolling Stone Baker, she also purchased a large quantity of mushrooms and made a dish for last fall's farm-to-table event at the County Line Orchard.
That's Kathy Sipple with the Co-Thrive Time Bank talking about how a wild edibles hike managed from a project with the Dune Learning Center came as an inspiration for the Time Bank itself. And in turn, the Time Banks picked up another Local Innovators Award from the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana. The availability of fresh water is very much linked to not only to our individual needs or our business needs, but also to economic prosperity in general, our communities to stay thriving and growing, and even biodiversity as well. Wouldn't necessarily think of that. A lack of fresh water causes a lot of problems on the other side of the ledger. David Reed has written a book which is entitled Water Security and U.S. Foreign Policy, and he is with us to talk about not only the book, but also about some of the problems that we run into as we find a shortage of fresh water in places, an abundance, overabundance in some cases, no thanks to global warming in others as well, too. Dr. Reed, thank you very much for being with us on the program today.
Great pleasure. Glad to be with you.
Well, give us a little premise here on the thoughts that you had, obviously with your work with the WWF as a senior policy advisor, but also just in general as writing a book that deals with a lot of water. And, of course, it's a topic of which we here on the very south edge of Lake Michigan are very, very concerned about.
Our starting point is the fact that water really is foundational for life. Water determines who prospers and who doesn't. It really determines what economies are going to thrive and which won't. And we are entering a period in the human experience where we are facing a series of threats to our water supplies that are really quite unlike any others that we've ever faced. And that set of challenge of threat is what really motivated WWF to undertake this study. These studies were carried out in 14 countries, 14 regions around the world.
Do you find, in doing the research on this, that it came up when the data came back, and in turn what you've used to help put the book together, that we have not only communities and countries as well that are very concerned about proper water management, or maybe in some places where water is not managed at all?
That's absolutely right. And it's really shocking to discover that some countries don't even have national water laws. They don't have national regulations. And a good example of that is in Guatemala, where, in fact, they want to avoid national water laws because it allows the economic elites to gain access to water. And unfortunately, it really ends up punishing many of the poor people in that country. And so, Chris, the point is that when they can't survive in their communities and their neighborhoods, they move to the cities. And from there, they often move to the United States looking for work. So these are global issues, but they're not unattached from what's going to affect our well-being and our national security.
We talk here about global climate problems, changes, and to be like, of course, in some cases, the extreme weather has caused a lot of problems, leading to a lack of access to water supplies. And that, of course, as we mentioned, is going to have a great deal of impact on countries' economies, as well as the environment in those places, as well as just residents' stability and the like. Where else do we see that we're having problems, water-related problems, at least, with climate change?
The headlines in the past few years have included stories about Syria, the Syrian civil war. I don't think we appreciate enough. The fact is that that civil war grew out of a five-year drought, and tens upon tens of thousands of farmers out in the countryside in the northeastern part of the country simply could not survive, and they started moving to the cities. And in this number, they ran up against the corruption of the al-Assad regime. So what started as a migration to try to survive because of drought ended up converting into a protest against the corruption and the incapacity of the entire government. And so from that came this massive migratory movement that actually has put millions of people in the motion across the Middle East and up into Europe. Just one other quick example is what has happened in Nigeria. The headlines have often been about Boko Haram, this insurgency that has captured young women and imprisoned them and taken them off. Fact is that that crisis also grew out of drought and the disappearance. Lake Chad was a lake that was in four different countries in the central part of Africa. It's dried up. There's only 5% that is viable today. And as a consequence, these communities, the fishermen, the agriculturalists, have had to move and are trying to survive. And that has fueled the sense of desperation, the need to join other movements that will help overcome their plight and their desperation.
We've already learned that the Trump administration makes plans to make some changes to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency that affects water quality and protecting water supplies along the Great Lakes, among other places in particular, and elsewhere in the country, I'm sure. What kind of impact does the World Wildlife Foundation seem to be concerned about as the administration continues on that might affect water supplies and water access here in the United States?
Well, I think you nailed it. We are very concerned about the budget. The president's budget is calling for a 30% reduction in our overseas development assistance, is calling for a 35% reduction in our diplomatic corps. Those are the people, those are the front lines, if you will, and these efforts try to tamp down these coming crises. it's been really encouraging to hear voices such as Admiral Mike Mullen and General Jim Jones saying, we have got to maintain our development assistance budget, because if we don't, then we're going to end up having to buy more bullets. In fact, Secretary of Defense James Mattis said exactly those words. Let's not have to buy more bullets. Let's take care of these issues before they really get to this, what they call the kinetic level. That's actual conflict. We don't want that. So as you have pointed out, the budget affects not only the international arena, as I'm highlighting, but as you pointed out, about the domestic budget and how we manage these very precious resources in our own country that are going to be under more and more pressure. So it's a huge challenge, and we need to tap into those voices on Capitol Hill. And thank goodness there are some really strong advocates on Capitol Hill that are looking at these issues and really trying to protect our environment.
Okay. Now, Dr. Reed, you've mentioned here already some of the work that the WWF has been trying to do in research and the like to help make sure that the water supplies don't dwindle any more than they already have, increase if possible, too. Tell us about some of the other things that the WWF is doing in this area of research as well as leadership.
I think one of the most exciting things that WWF does is working with major corporations. We have been asked by Hilton Hotel, by Coca-Cola Corporation, to work with them to go right into the heart of their plants and their hotels, how to make them more efficient to use less water. But even beyond that, they're asking us, how can you work with the communities upstream, whether it's in El Salvador, Guatemala, or Mexico, and countries around the world? Work with the communities upstream, provide them with the education, the facilities, so that we can make sure that the water is flowing for them and also for the companies. That's one of the major areas that WWF has acquired great expertise. A second area is that we are working with in river basins around the world. We are developing what we call water basin report cards. And this is providing analysis and data to governments in that basin on what's happening and what they need to do to try to address the major problems. So it's short-term, working with companies, but long-term, working with governments to plan and protect for the future.
Dr. David Reed is a senior policy advisor at the World Wildlife Fund, and he's also the author of a book which is entitled Water Security and U.S. Foreign Policy. It talks about the implications and the risks of the rapidly changing changes that happen in water supplies, overabundance in some, but mostly the scarcity of water in others here on our planet, and what this means for Americans as well. Dr. Reed, thank you very much for spending time to talk with us about this.
Been a pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
The Legacy Foundation is getting ready to hold a unique countywide one-day conversation this fall to break bread, so to speak, and talk about how to make Lake County a better place to live and work. Just before the Legacy Foundation's recent annual meeting got underway, I sat down with Legacy Foundation President Carolyn Saxton about this upcoming event.
On the Table was started by the Chicago Community Trust 4 years ago, and the idea was to gather information from people in small settings, usually over a meal, maybe breakfast, lunch, dinner, maybe snacks, maybe wine and cheese. They could be at a personal home, it might be in the workplace, it might be in a restaurant, wherever anyone would like to host, this is where we might have this type of event. Usually it's about 6 or 8 people at a table. And the idea is it's an unfacilitated conversation. And the conversation is about opportunities for the area where you live, some of the challenges, some of the things that you might see that you would like to happen in your community. And after those on the table experiences, there's a survey that people fill out and send it in either by email or those that they might pick up at the event. And from that, we'll be gathering information that we will use, that Legacy Foundation will use, to determine plans for the next year through our strategic initiatives.
What
got the Legacy Foundation interested in using this concept, rather than, say, a larger setting? Because there have been a lot of community conversations around in the region. Lakeshore Public Media sponsored a few of them around the community, especially talking about particular issues involving race and policing and other type of very serious issues. What seems to appeal about having this type of a much more intimate setting to have a conversation?
Well, I think one of the things is that this won't be a guided conversation. So, as you mentioned, some of the other conversations have been on particular topics. These will not be on a particular topic. It'll kind of be organic, whatever it is that people want to talk about at the table. And because people are going to know one another, they may be more open in their conversations. But I think the other thing that is really critical in this process is that we want to have these conversations throughout all of Lake County. We want to know what the people in Lowell think, what the people in Gary think, what the people in Hobart, in Whiting, in Hammond, in Munster, all of the communities that are located in Lake County. And so when we gather these conversations together or gather these events together, there'll be conversations that will be able to say, this is what we know Lowell wants for their community. This is what Munster wants for their community. And will help us guide specific initiatives for those communities, but also for Lake County as a whole. So it's a little bit different in a couple of different ways.
Do you think that this might be perhaps the best way that the Legacy Foundation can find out the areas of need, the areas that need to be improved, rather than just a big conversation that you'll get more information out of it than just a general survey that might go out to the public, you say?
Well, I think one of the things that we want to do is engage people in the process. So just doing a survey, I don't think is really a true engagement tool, although you can gather information. Sometimes you may not get the responses, the number of responses that you would like to have. And so our hope is that by engaging these individuals and the participants in these conversations, that we'll be able to engage them in future action for their communities as well.
Now, you had a chance to bring this up here at the 24th annual meeting of the Legacy Foundation on Tuesday, May 2nd. What kind of timetable would you like to see these on-the-table conversations get started here in Lake County?
Well, the interesting thing about this process, it's a one-day event. So all of these conversations will take place on September 26th. Except for maybe a few organizations, I think the Rotary Clubs may do them during that week, but they are all going to be held on September 26th. So that way we will get people together throughout the county on one day, over a meal, over coffee and donuts or a lunch or a dinner or in people's homes to talk about what they'd like to see for their community. And so from that one day, then we'll be able to use the information that is provided through the surveys that they complete to help us in the future.
Now, if you plan for this event on September 26th, you get the data coming in, the comments coming in. After that, what kind of plan do you have to go with this information that you gathered forward?
Well, the University of Illinois in Chicago was hired by the Knight Foundation to put together all of the results of the survey. And they're doing that not just for Legacy Foundation, but for 9 other community foundations across the country who are participating. The other community foundations are doing theirs at different times of the year. Ours is the only one on September 26th. But the University of Illinois will be providing us with the results of all of the surveys. And we hope to have all of those results back within about 8 to 10 weeks after the event. I want to use the example of Lexington, Kentucky. They were selected by the Knight Foundation also. Lexington, Kentucky held theirs in March, and they had a goal of reaching 5,000 people. They reached 11,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow, is really it. We have a goal of 1,500 people. We would love to reach more than that. We already have 100 hosts who are willing to provide some type of get-together and host those either in their homes or at their place of work or wherever it is that they might that they might be. I think what we really are shooting for is between 200 and 250 hosts on that day, so we can get to the number that we have as our goal.
That's Carolyn Saxton with the Legacy Foundation of Lake County talking about this coming September's On the Table Countywide One-Day Conversation Series.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem-solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. When we as a society look at innovation in history, sometimes we get caught up in who was the president of that company or who was the scientist behind that discovery. And we forget that anyone can start something new from any position in society. In this episode, we get to see how innovative women from different walks of life came together to push Indiana to be the first. According to Annette Sherber, public history graduate student at IUPUI, it was Hoosier women that were behind Indiana becoming the first state to introduce a statewide ban on laundry detergent containing phosphates. Before World War II, laundry was done with soap. Not what we call soap today. Real soap made of animal fat and oil. But once World War II started, animal fats and oils were rationed, and scientists needed to find a new way to get things clean. They found chemicals like phosphates cleaned things like no other. But according to Annette Sherber, there was one problem with using phosphates in laundry detergent.
As more and more people started using these phosphate-based laundry detergents, you know, they went from washing machines down the drain, you know, through sewer systems, they eventually ended up into waterways.
And once phosphates got into waterways like the Great Lakes, they acted like a fertilizer and made plants like algae grow out of control.
So you can imagine the lakes turned green and slimy and smelly and just, you know, overall sort of disgusting because they just had all this algae growing in them.
Algae growth is not just smelly and disgusting. It can be harmful to the marine and plant life and humans who drink the water. But the change was gradual enough that it took several years for people to become concerned. Scientists working with the International Joint Commission between the U.S. and Canada were noticing problems in waterways from the late 1950s to the early 60s. To fix this issue, there were two options: either ban phosphates from things like laundry detergents, or improve water treatment plants to filter out harmful phosphates. The Joint Commission between the U.S. and Canada recommended that the U.S. and Canada immediately ban all phosphate detergents and encourage industries to make non-phosphate detergents. This would immediately reduce the amount of phosphates in waterways, whereas building new treatment centers would take time. In the meantime, Time magazine ran stories in the late 60s exposing the phosphate pollution to the public, and people started to realize their impact on the earth around them. And people, especially women, became concerned.
And oftentimes, you know, they would form these lobbying groups in a way. Sometimes they would stand outside grocery stores and pass out handbills with these lists of percentages of phosphates and detergents, or, you know, try to convince other women, you know, to buy more ecologically conscious goods. Sometimes they even formed their own organizations. So, for one example, in Indianapolis, there was the Northside Environmental Action Committee. It was formed by some local housewives, and they were concerned with just how do women as consumers contribute to pollution. And so they started advocating, you know, multiple ways that women could change their buying habits to help improve the environment. And one of those was buying the non-phosphate detergent. And they also became really active politically.
Women organized around phosphate detergents in a powerful way. For some women, this was their first foray into politics. And because of the subject matter, it attracted homemakers in a specific and direct way. However, groups like the League of Women Voters were also active in the anti-phosphate lobbying. But even for some of these seasoned activists, it was their first foray into ecological issues. The lobbying from Hoosier women worked, and the Indiana legislature passed a ban on phosphate laundry detergents from being sold in stores. However, after it was passed, but before it went into effect, pushback against the ban began.
The Senate Ecology Committee, when they were considering whether to repeal the ban or not, they decided to hold these public hearings to see what the public felt. And so Betty Lou James was the president of the Indiana Home Economics Association, and so she testified at one of these hearings. And in her eyes, you know, we're environmentalists. They just thought of there should be a different route to go to treat this pollution. And so they were concerned about the environment. They didn't think that it was time to, you know, ban phosphate detergents. They wanted industry to develop something that was definitely safe before the ban was put in place.
The fear stemmed from the fact that a child died from swallowing non-phosphate detergent. Additionally, some women were worried that the chemicals in the new detergents were also unsafe and could break down into carcinogens in the water, even though these claims were unsubstantiated by scientists. The Attorney General of the U.S. was also afraid and issued a statement that people should just continue to use phosphate detergents in the name of safety. This caused quite a hubbub in Indiana, which was about to go through with the ban. But the ban did go through on January 1st, 1972, making Indiana the first state in the United States to ban phosphate detergents.
You know, some documents that I found or some letters, and, you know, they call it like a landmark piece of legislation. And some Hoosiers were actually, you know, really excited that Indiana was the first in something. And they were, you know, they were hopeful that Indiana would become this nationwide leader in water quality.
As of 2013, only 27 states have bans on phosphate detergents. In fact, this problem is not behind us at all. In 2015, there was a huge algae bloom in Lake Erie, the size of New York City, the biggest recorded algae bloom in history. According to Annette, there are more factors at play than just phosphate detergents. Agricultural runoff and global warming are more severe now and are playing a large part as well. Annette admits that Indiana is not generally first in a lot of things, especially related to environmental regulations. But this time, there might be a clue in the fact that the first director of the EPA, William Ruckelshaus, was a Hoosier and was the director at the time of the ban. Regardless of the reason, women were the driving force behind this innovative move.
I think, for one, it matters because it shows, you know, women participating in science and technology in ways that maybe people don't really think about when they think about women in STEM. You know, the first thing that comes to mind, at least for me, is, you know, women going to college, getting a degree in physics or biology, and then, you know, becoming a professional biologist or becoming a professor in the sciences on a college campus. But I think, you know, looking at instances like this where women, you know, decided to become involved in these discussions because it interests them, because it concerned them, also shows, you know, women participating in these fields, even when it was hard for them to gain admission or influence, you know, discussions around these debates.
These women show us that to dabble in science, you don't need to be a scientist. Whether you're a scientist or a seasoned activist, or you're just concerned about the laundry detergent you use, you can ignite something innovative to help the environment around you. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives by creating and facilitating programs that encourage Hoosiers to think, read, and talk. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, and I'm Sandra Burton.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, we'll have more on the Excel Center, which is a new facility in Hammond that gives adult students a chance to earn not a GED, but a full-fledged Core 40 diploma. We hope you'll join us for that.